Hello.
Hey Dina.
How are you?
Hey, is there like a waiting room feature with this one?
A waiting room? No. People will log in using their email addresses and then they'll be admitted right away. So it looks like maybe somebody from your family is already on, Rebecca.
Oh my God. Well, I'm very honored.
But so basically for the next 10 minutes, we are actually technically recording and people can hear this, but I'll trim this out from the final recording.
Okay, wonderful. This is
And then I'll
really
be sharing it to the YU Alumni Facebook page as well. It'll be live streaming on Facebook.
cool. So this is my document, the one here. Hold on. So here's my document, but now I lost. Okay, I've screened it. Let me put that down 1 second. And hold on a second.
Yep.
Okay, so to share, let me just see if that'll be there. And I just share that and then it's there. Okay, fine. And oh, so half an hour and then 15 minutes with questions?
Yeah, like 30 to 35 minutes of presentation. I'll put in the chat that people can submit their questions. I don't want to distract you though, or interrupt you, especially if you're in the middle of a train of thought. So what we've been doing is keeping the questions till the end, and then just sort of depending on how it's going, I'll either read the questions off, or if people like raise their hand, which they can do virtually, I have been actually like calling on people and unmuting them so that they can
Oh,
ask.
that's great. That's
Yeah.
great. It's basically two sources. So
Okay.
maybe, as I finish up the first source, maybe I'll open up to a few questions just about that source so that we don't lose, if they have questions. I don't know. Does that make sense to you just for a few minutes?
Totally. Yeah, whatever you have to share is great. I will say though, I'm looking at your video. I'm just wondering if maybe there's something on your camera. It's a little bit blurry.
No, that was it was blurry today. You know what? Let me get a cloth. Okay.
Okay.
Hold on a second.
It looks like it's something just on the lens because in the bottom corner it's pretty clear.
How's that?
Much better. Much, much
Yeah.
better.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for noticing. Yeah,
Sure.
noticing something. I thought it was like the light in here or something, but
Oh, yeah. No, that's much, much better.
okay.
So I'm going to go ahead and mute myself right now. And if you want to mute yourself too, you can. And like I said, this will record, but I'll trim this whole first, 10 or 15 minutes out.
Great, great.
And I'll
All
just
right.
let you know whenever you are ready to get started. We're not really doing intros. We're really just sort of getting into it. So
Great,
I'll
great.
give you the heads up and holler if you need anything. I'm here.
Okay, great. Thank you. Hi. Let's see who's here. Okay.
And I have the streaming live on Facebook as well, so people will start tuning in there too.
Okay, great. So let's see.
And Ronnie, whenever you feel like getting started, go ahead. I'll just trim everything before you begin.
Okay. I don't see any of the participants. So they're there.
I have everybody's camera off just for, you know, so there are no distractions.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. All right. Okay. All right. Here we are. If you have any questions, any technical questions, you can definitely put it in the chat and Dina will be able to help with that. My name is Ronnie Pareles. I have the great honor of teaching Jewish history at Yeshiva University. And it's really a wonderful opportunity to be here tonight with all of you. You know, technology sometimes gives us the opportunity to connect with people who are far away that normally couldn't come to a class or to a talk. And it's really special to connect with people all over the world right now. I just want to give you parameters for the class. It's going to be about half an hour of me, and then time for questions at the end. You can also put questions into the chat so that you know, and then that will be moderated. We're going to be looking at two main texts tonight. So in between the two texts, I'll also take a stop and we can get questions and we can talk a little bit. So it'll be somewhat interactive. And I just want to begin. I want to begin right now. So we're going through a worldwide period of darkness, of difficulty, of confusion. And for many of us, looking to the past gives us perspective, gives us insight, gives us wisdom. And I hope that tonight we get just a little drop of that from two interesting, very different, and yet at the same time, very connected poems from medieval Spain. And the first one is definitely, on some level, apparently the darker one. It's known as a dance of death, dance macabre in the French form, a danza de la muerte in the Spanish form. And this was a style of poetry, which was a performative poem. It was generally performed as a dance at special occasions, whereby the main figure is the figure of death, and death comes to town and no one can escape. And it's a way to kind of and through the poem, the figure of death knocks down everybody, the most powerful, the emperors, the popes, to the simple laborers. It goes throughout society. And throughout Europe, where you see this poem, which very, very popular in the wake of the Black Death in the 14th century, wherever you see it, it is about Christians, because Europe at the time was almost all Christians, with very, very few Jews living in small pockets of Ashkenaz. But when you come to Sfarad, you see something very, very different. In Sfarad, when you get to medieval Spain, Jews and Muslims are an important part of society. They're an important feature of people's everyday life. And it's a way that the Christian majority understands itself in relationship to those minorities. And so in the Spanish Danza de la Muerte, the dance of death in Spain, you find two very well-developed figures One is a rabbi and one is an al-faqih, a Muslim jurist. And those two figures feature prominently towards the end in the Spanish version. And it's something that sets it apart from all the other European versions. And this, the last 2 weeks, as things have gotten darker and thinking of the plague, I went back to this poem. It's a poem I first read in graduate school over 20 years ago. And I thought, let me go back here. Let me see what we can find here. So let's look at it together. I'm about to share the document. So here we are. I will have this, if you're interested, you can get a copy of this, this document. The first thing you see here is a scene, not from Spain, and on some level, not from the medieval period. This is one of the most famous, iconic scenes from Ingmar Bergman's masterpiece, The Seventh Seal, whereby this gentleman, the knight, comes back from a long crusade back to his native Sweden and encounters death on the shore. And they play a game of chess. And this is a major metaphor in this amazing 20th century film. And I love this image because it's an image of personification of death, but it's man trying to come to terms with that and with destruction that comes in its wake and the justice of it and the meaning behind it. So I used it as an evocative beginning. But let's go to our text. 1 minute, sorry. Okay. Here's the Spanish original, and here's my rough translation. So notice it begins with someone who you would think, if he'd be included, with a certain degree of maybe delicacy, of piety, but almost none of the religious figures in the Dance of Death escape scrutiny and ridicule, actually. And this is the sacristan, the sexton. And as you can see here from my translation, he's made fun of for his lascivious lifestyle, that even though he works in the church and has all sorts of holy jobs, he still finds time at night to visit the ladies and have a lot of fun. And so he, along with everyone else, will go the way of death. But then we find our rabbi. Come forth, rabbi, and here you will daven. Now, I say daven, which is clearly not a Sephardic word, but it is a contemporary English Jewish word. And for that reason, I used it because notice the word up here. Meldaredes, meldar. Now, those of you who know Spanish, meldar might not be a word you're familiar with. It is not a common Spanish word, but it is a common Sephardic word. It's a word that Spanish-speaking Sephardim have used for centuries to talk about tefillah and to talk about limud Torah. So when a Sephardic Jew goes to the Beit Knesset in Tangier or in Tetuan, they are going to meldar. That's what they're going to do. And that's the word that they use to talk about tefillah. And so in the translation, which I was trying to be very contemporary, I used the word daven, not to be confused with any Sephardic word. So he calls the rabbi to come and daven. And we see the next line. O Elohim, and God of Abraham, you who promised the redemption, I don't understand what you are doing to me with such fanfare. You command me to dance, but I don't know the tune. There is no man in the world of all those that exist who can escape from your command. Help me, Dayanim, because my understanding is slipping because of this affliction. And notice all the Hebrew. This is a Spanish text. This was not written by a Jew. This was not read and performed by Jews. This was a Spanish general text. And yet, notice all the Hebrew. Notice the very Jewishness of it. God of Abraham, redemption, and the call out to the Dayanim to help him. These are all signs, not only of the fact that this poet, this particular poet might have known Jews and knew about Judaism, but the fact that Jews were a central part of society, and that they were known as in that way. Let's look at the next line. And then Death says to him, he calls, right? Death calls him to dance. He's confused. And then Death calls to him, Don Rabbi Barbulo. Don Rabbi, which Don is a sign of nobility. He's calling him with a lot of respect, but not really, because he then goes to talk about his beard, who spends his day studying the Talmud and its commentaries, right? The Jew is marked not only by being studious, but studying particular things, studying the Talmud. And then later on, he says to him, you're no different than anyone else. You have to go with the dancers too and sing your baracha. And who do you sing it with? You're going to the same place as Rabbi Asa. And Asa, according to Sola Soleil, one of the great medievalists who studied this poem, is a reference to Isaac ben Sheshet Perfet, who's one of the great rabbis of Catalonia and Valencia, who fled after the riots of 1391. And now he goes on to the Al-Faqih, the Muslim. We're going to leave that one off. That one's a lot of fun as well. He makes fun of him for all sorts of Islamic sort of stereotypes. First of all, this Dance of Death doesn't deal with theodicy, does not deal with Tziduk HaDin. Why did God do this? How could God do this? It takes death as a reality. Death happens, and it happens to everybody, and no one's going to escape it. And so from that side, there's a real strong Kohelet element in it. But it also takes opportunity to have fun and to make fun of all the people in society, especially those that think that they're powerful and can escape this fate. And the other piece that I mentioned here that I wanted to kind of really zero in on is that one of the things that's hard for people to understand about the history of the Jews of Spain is that they were there for so long. They lived in Sfarad for hundreds of years as a robust, integrated community. They were not sidelined. They were not living down some tiny alleyway, hiding. Jews in Spain were an integral part of the urban landscape. They built beautiful synagogues. They were involved in government. And so you see that in this poem. It's a very natural evocation, even if it's stylized and meant to be caricatured. I want to show you an image that kind of brings that home. I'm going to go back to that text for a minute. Okay. So if we continue going, now look at this text, look at this image. You have two languages here. Hebrew. Please let me know if anyone has issues seeing this.
I'm not seeing the screen shared right now.
Okay, let me get back there then. Thank you so much. There we go. Okay. Thank you so much. So now everyone can see? Okay.
Yep,
so
you're good.
We have two, great. You see the two languages? The one on the right, yeah, it's Hebrew. The one on the left is Arabic. And if you look really carefully, if you blow up your image a little bit, okay, and you look really carefully in the middle, there is some images. There's castles and lions. And those of you who know anything about medieval Spain know that that is telling you we are in Castile, the land of the castles, which was joined with the kingdom of the lions, León. And this is one side of the monumental grave of Fernando III, who was one of the great Spanish kings who conquered most of this Islamic South. When he conquers the Islamic South, he obviously is very proud of his conquest, and he gains the title the saint for that. He's very, very, very excited by that. But when he dies, he makes sure to show that he is a king of all his subjects. And on his tombstone, his epitaph has Latin, Castilian, Hebrew, and Arabic. And again, this is just another sign of the rootedness of Jews and Muslims in Spanish society. And now I want to go back in time. We're going to look at Shmuel HaNagid. He lived a few hundred years, about 150 years before the plague. So about 150, 200 years before that poem was written. This is the Alhambra Palace, the beautiful Alhambra Palace in Granada, where he was not only the leader of the Jewish community, but the vizier, the prime minister of the Muslim kingdom of Granada. He led troops out to war. He saw battle. He saw intrigue at court. He saw people rise and fall. He himself came from a very humble background and rose up the administration of the Muslim kingdom of Granada. And the rumor is that this beautiful garden and the palace that surrounds it, this is only part of the Alhambra Palace, that the rumor is that this beautiful Patio de los Leones, the patio of the lions, was where Shmuel HaNagid lived. Now, we don't know, but they don't say those stories about you and me. So it tells you something about the sort of life this man led. Now, in addition to all those amazing accomplishments, Shmuel HaNagid is one of the greatest post-biblical poets of Hebrew. Few individuals covered the range of topics and with the power and lucidity of his pen. And at YU, I have the great honor and pleasure to teach Hebrew poetry in my medieval Spain course, and which I'm teaching right now, both at Stern and Uptown. And HaNagid is someone that we spend a lot of time with. So let's look at this poem. Now, this translation is not mine. This translation comes from the great translator and poet Pierre Cole from his book, The Dream of the Poem. Highly recommend reading this poem, this collection. And the Hebrew original is right down here. We'll take a look at it as well. All right. So the previous text we looked at was very jocular, was funny, was musical. But here we have something very different, and let's take a look. I crossed through a market where butchers hung oxen and sheep side by side. There were birds and herds of fatlings like squid, their terror loud as blood congealed over blood when slaughterers' knives opened veins. In booths alongside them, the fishmongers and fish in heaps and tackle like sand, and beside them, the street of the bakers whose ovens are fired through dawn. They bake, they eat, they lead their prey. They split what's left to bring home. And my heart understood how it happened and asked, who are you to survive? What separates you from those beasts which were born in you waking and labor and rest? If they hadn't been given by God for your meals, they'd be free. If he wanted this instant, he'd easily put you in their place. They breathe like you, and hearts which scatter them over the earth. There was never a time when the living didn't die, nor the young that they bear not give birth. Pay attention to this, you pure ones, and princes so calm in your fame. Know that if you'd fathom the words of the hidden, this is the whole of man. Very visceral images at the beginning. I want to ask in the comments if people can chat, what biblical images did you find here? What evocations or allusions do you see? What verses, what psukim might have been talked about and woven into the text? And as you do that, let's look at the Hebrew. And then we're going to go back and pick it all apart. Avarti al shuk tabachim, botson ishvarim al yadam. Yeah, I see some things. Let's see. Let's go back to the, let's see. What do you have? Kizekol adam. Oh, someone wrote Brit Ben Abitarim. Wow, interesting. Never thought of that one. Very nice. Brit Ben Abitarim because of the split, the animals being split, and he's kind of walking through it. Kizekol adam, which comes from Kohelet. Indeed. Anything else? Anyone else? If anything comes to mind? So let's go back to the poem a little bit. If something comes up, I will. All right. Okay. So first of all, the Kohelet allusion is very strong. In fact, Hanagid had the great fortune of not only being a beloved poet during his time. He was very popular and people loved his poems. They would copy them down, share them. But he had, he trained his children to appreciate scholarship and writing and poetry. And they collected and edited and copied and annotated his poems. And they put them into three different collections. One was Ben Tehillim. The next one is Ben Mishle, and the last one is Ben Kohelet. And the word Ben is a little bit weird, but it means kind of the product of, so to speak. And so the first one, Tehillim, are kind of a kolbo, a mix of different poems from, you know, everything from wine poems and elegies for people who he lost, to war poems. Real range of, in fact, one of the great anecdotes told by his son is that in one of the annotations of a poem, he says, my father composed this poem before going out to war because he didn't have time to say mincha. So he didn't have time to say mincha, but he had time to write a poem. And that poem we still have, thanks to his son and other people who preserved these things. But the last category, Ben Kohelet, right? The product of meditation on Kohelet is where this poem finds itself in. And these are kind of these very somber, very deep meditations on death and mortality and the purpose of life. And in my mind, I think they're his best poems. They're really just so powerful. And so the Kohelet element is very, very strong here. Let's begin at the beginning. I crossed through a market where butchers hung oxen and sheep side by side. Now, you know, autobiography in poetry is tricky because the poet isn't always speaking about themselves, and certainly not speaking about themselves directly, even when they say I. They're using a poetic voice, right? And they're placing all this into their character. But we can think about there's a wonderful folk element that I think he's picking up on. In the Muslim world, there's a trope of the king or the prince who dresses like a commoner to wander around his people to find out what they really think of him. And there are many wonderful folk tales about kings who go into the marketplace or who dress like simple people. And they find out all sorts of, you know, they gain wisdom in this way. So I think on some level, maybe that's a little bit, because the thought of someone like Shmuel Nagid, of his status, walking through the dirty butcher's lane in the shuk is hard to imagine. But who knows? Okay. So here he is meditating on the actions of the butchers, the fishmongers, even the bakers. right? And there's a violence to all of this. There's a real powerful, visceral violence that comes to mind. He is not, this is not, you know, going to the supermarket and buying a shrink-wrapped, perfectly clean chicken cutlet. Here he sees, you know, you see the animals in their physicalness, in their materiality. And that gets him thinking. That gets him thinking about his own life and where he is in the world and where man is in the world. And he also thinks about the people who work there, right? There's work, and that's honest work, and that's good work. And it's a cycle. They work, and then they go home, and then they start it up again. And that cyclical nature is again placed here. My heart understood how it happened and asked, who are you to survive? What is different between me and that animal? Now, we know from thinking about Vayikra, which we start this week, that that element of you know, smicha, putting your hands on an animal and doing confession, the idea that an animal can kind of serve as this very powerful spiritual conduit for us to transform ourselves for tshuva and to think about, wow, that, you know, I deserve what this animal is, you know, I deserve death like this animal. Those sorts of ideas that we know from the Torah, I think are here as well, right? Seeing these other animals makes him think, what's the difference? And he comes to this realization where he understands that this is, that his place is given to him by God, but it will eventually leave. And then he turns in a social critique. He says to the pure ones, and let's see what the Hebrew is there towards the end. First of all, this line, look at how beautiful this line is. Lo nimtza et lo met bo met, o et lo yolid molidim. Right, there's never, you won't find a moment where a dead person won't die and where the birthers won't be giving birth, right? Life and death is happening all the time. It's constant. And sometimes a notable death happens and we stop, but death is happening all the time and birth is happening all the time. Life is renewed. We're living in the springtime. And for that reason, Pesach always has to be in Chag Aviv. It has to be a time of seeing renewal, seeing the ground that was dead for so long coming up again here in the north. All the flowers are coming up. My backyard that looked beyond dead is now being filled with green and little shoots of small flowers. That's life. Life is not only the blood and the rotting flesh. Life is also the sprouting and the renewal. And he ends, Lizok yasimu lev zakim, you pure ones, or maybe those who think they're pure, right, who think that their hands are clean. Unesichim ga'u bichvodam, the princes who are elevated, who are arrogant in their honor. He's talking about his class. He's that prince. But Nagid had, again, it's dangerous to make this too autobiographical, but Hanagid, because he came from humble roots, always remembered his place, always remembered that he could lose everything at this one moment. And so here you see it very clearly in the poem. He's talking to his class. You know, there was a whole class of Jewish courtiers, people who made it in society, who were working for the king, who had good positions, and who forgot the little man, who forgot the people who were suffering, forgot the people who were very vulnerable in society. And he's saying to them, don't think you're so special. Don't think you're so different. You've made your accomplishments. You have your riches and your pleasures. But remember, and if you would, imi vinu sod haolam yedu ki ze kol adam, which is the way Kohelet ends. Right, we end the book of Ecclesiastes, this great summation on the purpose of life or the difficulty of finding the purpose in life. And the one thing that Shlomo HaMelech Kohelet can go back to and hold on to is knowing that what is Kol Adam, what is the whole purpose of man? To fear God and do his commandments. That's what you have. So while you're on this earth, be it short, be it long, we know what we need to do. We don't know how long. We don't know why one person will die now and another person will die another day. But we do know what we can do, what's in our hands to do. So again, and this poem, again, doesn't try to justify God's ways. It is taking death and suffering as a reality. And its response to it is to be open-eyed and to never let go of the mitzvot, to never let go of ethics and caring for other people and serving God. That is the ultimate. There's a lot more to talk about. I'd love to hear some questions. So I'm going to stop this sharing and let's see what we got. Okay. So questions, it can be about the first text, the second text, about anything you're interested in. I'm here.
If people have questions, you should raise your hands and I will unmute your microphone. We can give people another minute to think of questions if we
want. Yeah, take your time. I'm going to drink a little water.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I see
VR.
Hi.
So do you think that was the dance of death something that was common amongst many cultures or some type of concept similar to that? I wasn't sure if
yes. I meant to talk about this. So thank you. Yes, it's actually, I consulted with some of my other medievalist friends, and there's a wonderful scholar, Michelle Hamilton, who has a chapter dedicated to the dance of death in Spain. And in particular, what she's interested in is something completely amazing, which is the body of what's known as aljamiado literature. The aljama refers to the community. It's an Arabic word that means community, and it refers to either the Jewish community or the Muslim community. And aljamiado texts are texts which are Spanish, but are written in either Hebrew or Arabic. And she has found Hebrew and Arabic versions of the Dance of Death. And she also shows, based on other scholars as well, that actually that term, danse macabre, right, in French, is actually not a French word in its origin. It is a Hebrew origin word. It comes from mekabrim, those who bury, and that its roots are actually in Jewish burial practices. Now, I want to understand this better. This is something that I just started researching, and I'm sure there's more, and there's probably a machloket that I haven't seen, but fascinating to think that this poetic tradition and this performative tradition, because we have all sorts of descriptions of how it was performed. There's a very lavish description of at one of the coronations of one of the Aragonese kings, where this was performed as one of these metaphorical dance performances that they would do in the medieval period, and so the idea that this exists throughout the Mediterranean, in Islamic and Jewish contexts, and in obviously in Christian contexts, which is much more well known, and we even have it in our day, the great band, The Grateful Dead. This is where they take their imagery from, right? So yes, but again, the devil is in the details. How is death in the Jewish and often the Muslim tradition is very much about the Malach HaMavet, which is very, very prominent. And it's different than death in the Christian tradition. And you know, the details is what is where you see the interesting gaps. Yeah. Great question. Thank you. Can people say where they're from? I'm curious where everyone's from.
I'm going to allow everyone to talk so we can open up the conversation here.
Yeah.
New York City.
Welcome.
Panama.
Panama. Give honor to Panama. Tenu kavod.
Michigan.
Michigan. Wonderful.
Cincinnati.
Cincinnati. Fantastic. Wow, it's really special what we can do with this stuff. It'd be better to see each other in person, but sometimes that is more complicated to pull off, right? I see sunny Florida from my parents. It's great. Easy nachas. All right. Well, it's been great. My email is very simple, Perellis, my last name, at yu.edu. If you ever have questions, I also will say that the Revel Grad School, where I teach as well, we have auditing options, and little by little, we are getting much more online options. If people want to come and audit a course or start a master's or a PhD, you should think about that. And know that that's an option, even if you don't live in New York City, little by little. I'm happy to talk to you about that as well. Really thank you. Thank you to Dina for putting this together and to the alumni network. And and thanks for taking time out. Even though we have a lot of time, it's amazing how the day fills up, right? So thank you. Thank you all for coming together.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay healthy, everyone.
Bye-bye.